The second round of federal COVID relief checks are hitting bank accounts. Have you received yours? We're talking about these payments and what you can expect here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The checks amount to $600 for each qualifying adult and child. Do you qualify? What do you want to know about who won't be getting a check? Or what if you switched bank accounts? It's 800-642-1234. Michelle Singletary is a personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, where she writes the nationally syndicated column, The Color of Money. Michelle, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So give us a primer first here. Who qualifies for the second round of stimulus checks?
So when you're looking at what your income is, so if you make $75,000 or less, you're going to qualify for the full $600, $1,200 for if you're married filing a joint return. And then the income levels switch if you're head of household or whether you're filing a married joint return. So, again, most people who are making, you know, $75,000 or less will qualify for the $600.
And when it comes to the children, what will these checks look like for families with children?
So for each qualifying child, you'll get an additional $600. And qualifying child means if your child is 17 years old or younger. So if your kid is older than 17, you won't get the extra $600 for your child.
How do people receive the funds for their children if a child was born in 2020, since they're not on their 2019 tax filing?
That's right. So you'll have to wait until you file your 2020 return this year when the tax season opens. So there are many people who their return wasn't processed in time, or perhaps the IRS used their 2018 return and their income, you know, just didn't qualify them for a stimulus payment. So you'll be looking at what, in the case of income, what you earn for 2020, whether if you qualify for the stimulus payment, you'll get the $1,200 plus the additional $600. Everything is automatic this round, the second round. So there's nothing that you can do to get the payment. If you got a payment before, they'll automatically send you the extra $600.
What about people who are green card holders? What about mixed status households?
Well, in the first round under CARES, mixed status households weren't allowed to get the payment. They changed that for the second payment so that they can, if they can get the $600, and then when you file your return, you can go back and claim the $1,200.
Will the IRS garnish stimulus checks in any way if you owe back taxes?
They did. The only offset for the CARES payment, the $1,200, was for back child support.
Okay.
For the $600, there is no offset. So in that case, you'll get the full $600. But anything else, like if you owe back taxes, they will not garnish or take any of the stimulus payment.
So, Michelle, who doesn't get one of these checks?
So if you are claimed as a dependent on another person's for the second stimulus payment, if you're claimed as a dependent on another taxpayer's 2019 tax return, for example, a child or a student, you are not eligible for a stimulus payment. If you don't have a Social Security number that is valid for employment, you won't get a payment. If you're a non-resident alien, and people who died before 2020, also estate and trusts, can't, you know, get the stimulus payment.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Michelle Singletary. She's a personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, and she's fielding your questions on this second round of stimulus checks, your situation. What do you think of the stimulus checks being sent out? Do you think these funds should have come sooner? What do you think about the amount? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michelle, the COVID bill says that the Treasury Department has until the 15th of this month to provide these checks to families. But how soon can we expect to see them?
Well, they said they've started sending the checks out already. They've mm-hmm. started to send out. Well, first of all, if you have direct deposit information with the IRS from the previous stimulus payment, you should be getting a direct deposit. If you, for example, change your bank account or something, then you won't get that deposit because they don't know where to send it, and you can't do anything to update that information. So you'll just have to wait until you file your return to get that money. Or you could get a check, or it's very important that you could also get a stimulus debit card.
That's what I've been hearing about.
Yeah, and lots of people are confused about that. So, for example, you might have got a direct deposit the first time, and for whatever reason, you're now getting a debit card. I just heard from a reader was a little confused about that because the bank, that the issuing bank, MetaBank, is not one that's well known to people. Now, the first round when they sent out debit cards, lots of people thought it was a fraud and they threw the card away.
Or maybe a credit card offer.
That's right. That's right, because you get so many of those. So you should watch your mail very carefully and look for anything like this. So if you get a, you know, the stimulus debit card, and the letter should indicate that, even though it's from a bank that you might not have heard from. So look for that as a possibility of delivering your stimulus funds.
Let's bring in Sarah now in Brookfield with a question. Sarah, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. This is Sarah Brookfield. I have a question. So before COVID, you know, my husband and I, we filed together. We made a good amount of money, and so we didn't qualify for any of the stimulus checks. I was laid off in March of 2020, and so technically I really should qualify for the stimulus payouts, but we're not because of basing it on 2019 tax returns. Will we be able to go back in time once we file our 2020 tax returns and then qualify for those stimulus checks?
So the good news, Sarah, is that the stimulus funds are actually an advance credit for your 2020 return. Because people, they wanted to get the money out very quickly, they used 2018 and 2019 returns. But actually, the money is based on your 2020 income. So if your income declined, as it has for many people, they lost their job or maybe they retired, then you can qualify for, it's called the recovery rebate credit. So on your the tax form, there'll be a line that asks you that. So you should get actually $1,800. If you have a qualifying income, like if you don't make more as a joint couple, $150,000, so you could get as much as $1,800, $1,200 from the first round and $600 from the, well, double that if you're filing jointly, from the second round.
Sarah, does that make sense?
So actually, I'm going to redo the math. So you'll get the $2,400. If both of them qualify for their joint income, they'll actually get the $2,400 plus $1,200 if you're married filing jointly. Now, make sure you pay attention to the income threshold. So if you meet both income thresholds, you could get that much.
Sarah, thank you for that question. Let's bring in Kevin now in Appleton with a question. Kevin, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what is your question about your stimulus check?
Well, I received a direct deposit for the stimulus, but in my direct deposit account, it was for $1,200, and I was under the assumption that the stimulus was $600. So now I'm a little confused because I just recently went through a divorce that was final last year, and I'm wondering if maybe my ex-wife $600 was deposited into my bank account, and the first round of the stimulus check, everything was fine with that. She received her own money. I believe she received a paper check. So I don't know, she's not on my bank account at all. So I don't know if there was a mistake at the IRS or if I'm getting an extra $600 for a dependent or how that works. So any help would be for clarification,
so let me,
would be great.
So let me ask you a quick question. So you're saying in the first round you each got a $1,200 check. Were you divorced at that time? You weren't.
We were.
So for 2019, you filed individual returns. Is that correct? Okay.
That's correct.
So okay, and so now you're saying you got another $1,200 check, a deposit.
That's correct.
So it could be an error. Yeah, are you in good terms with your ex? Can you call and find out whether or not if she got another $1,200, then there probably is some glitch somewhere that they doubled it because they maybe looked at, I don't know. They should have looked at your 2019 return and saw that you were filing individually. So there have been glitches like that. So I would check with your ex, because at some point the IRS may rectify that and they'll come back and get that money. So I would inquire with her, or just call the IRS and ask them, if this was an error. So only spend $600 and keep the other $600 just in case they come back and say, oh, oops, we made a mistake.
Well, Kevin, quick question. Is there a child, a dependent involved?
Yes. We have two children, and I claim one, and then she claims the other.
Oh, well, then that's it then, probably. Because you get $600. Is your child under 17?
Yes.
So that's probably what it is, that if you claim one and she claims that one, then that's what the extra $600 is then.
Okay, and that's why I was confused, because I thought that might be, but then I wasn't sure, because I keep hearing just $600 only, but there was no mention of dependents this round.
Yeah, dependents 17 and under, you get an extra $600. So if you guys are splitting the two dependents and they're both under 17, then that is the extra $600.
All right, Kevin, thank you so much for that question. Sleuthing it out there. We're talking about the second round of stimulus checks with Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. If you received your check, how did you use it? Or what will you put it toward? If you're waiting, could you look up your status on the IRS website tool called Get My Payment, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Michelle Singletary here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A second round of stimulus payments are being mailed out or direct deposited already into bank accounts on file with the IRS. We're getting your questions answered on when your payment will arrive, if it hasn't come already. We're fortunate to have personal finance columnist Michelle Singletary of The Washington Post as our guide to these stimulus check questions. Let's take another question. John is in Mason. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Good morning. What is your question?
My question is on behalf of my sister. She hasn't worked for a few years. She stays at home because our soon-to-be 89-year-old father lives with her, and she takes care of him. She was told by a tax preparer she didn't need to file any income tax because she doesn't make any. If she just filed a simple easy 1040 or whatever that is, would she be able to get the first and second stimulus checks?
Yes, she should be able to. So before the second round, there was a non-filer's tool that she could have used to file to get the first $1,200. You don't have to have income to claim the credit. But she'll have to wait to file a 2020 return when the tax season opens up in a couple of weeks. And so then when she files, she should be able to get both the $1,200 since she has no income, she should qualify for the whole thing, $1,200 for the first round and $600 from the second round.
John,
okay,
thank you.
Yeah. Very much.
Thanks for that question. Sarah now in Rice Lake is with us with a situation. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I had a quick question about we received a $600 stimulus for this round. But we have a family of four. I have a 17-year-old and a 21-year-old, and I understand I wouldn't get it for the 21-year-old. But we only got $600 this time, and I was wondering if it was for some reason because this year we did married filing separately, and if you could speak about that.
So you're asking about the child. So you said your child is 17. So you have to be, not 17. So 17 and under. So it's because your child is 17 that you didn't get the extra $600.
Well, but I only got one $600 payment, and I have me, my husband, and my 17-year-old.
So you said you filed married separately, right? You don't file a joint
return. Married filing separately. Yep.
Right. So then when your husband files, does he file?
Yeah, we both filed.
Did he get his $600?
We don't know who got the $600. We just got one $600 payment. It didn't say who it was for. We have the same bank account.
So it's based on your filing and also your income. So if you are filing separate returns, then you would get two separate payments.
Okay, that's why I was asking.
Right, you should probably call the IRS to find out. You know, you could also go on Get My Payment on IRS.gov, and it should indicate whose payment that was that hit your direct deposit account.
Is that Get My Payment tool on IRS.gov, is that up and running now to show the status of stimulus payments?
Yes, it is running now, so you can check the status of your payment. It's not always perfect because if there's some sort of glitch, it won't tell you that status is not, you know, they can't obtain your status. In that case, of course, the IRS is going to be swamped with calls. You can try to call them. Eventually, you should get a form that indicates the payment. So in her case, she should get a form that says what the payment was and who it was for.
And I understand that this Get My Payment site tool also shows you the status of your first stimulus payment?
Yes, it should show the status of your payments, right?
Okay. What does that mean, Michelle, when it says payment status not available if you go to that portal?
Yeah, for a lot of people, especially for the first stimulus payment, it meant that they may have been still processing your 2019 return. And so because they haven't been able to determine your eligibility, that's why they can't determine your status of the payment.
Okay. We are talking with personal finance columnist Michelle Singletary of The Washington Post, and she's breaking down what we need to know about the latest round of stimulus checks. Let's go to Pete now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Pete. What is your situation?
Hi, good morning. So my situation was in 2019, we were under the threshold and received the first stimulus package check. And then we also got one for this latest round. But in 2020, our income is probably going to be over that threshold. Are they going to be asking for that money back to where we shouldn't use it? Or if it's paid, are we safe?
You are safe. They are not going back to snatch the payments. That's why for people who qualify for either 2018 or 2019, especially with the first payment, they're in luck, because if your income went up for 2020, which is really the credit is based on your 2020 income, but they are not going to come back and pay and take payments that they've already issued.
Okay.
So you can keep the money. It is yours.
All right, Pete, thank you for that question. Let's bring in Jill now in Madison. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, ladies. My situation is that of a dependent that is no longer a dependent. I claimed my daughter when she was 18 in 2019. At a time during income tax time, she was a dependent. She's living with me. A couple of months later in May, she had a birthday. She found an apartment. She started college. So she's been by herself for about, you know, a little over a year and a half. And obviously she didn't get the first stimulus check, which was kind of devastating for her. So this time around, I still have a dependent at home. So I'm going to keep his for our home. And I'm going to end up having to give her my $600 so she can fix her car and catch up with her rent payment.
So if your daughter is self-supporting and she's out on her own and you are not going to claim her, then she can, when she files her own return, is she working? I would assume she's working.
Yes.
So she's going to file her tax return. So when she files her 2020 return, she can claim the $1,200 plus the $600, but you need to make sure that you don't claim her. And if you don't claim her, then yes, she can get the $1,200 plus the $600 for a total of $1,800 when she files her return this tax season.
Oh, that would be beautiful. We had no idea. She would be very excited to hear that.
Right, yeah. Just make sure you don't claim her. And out on her own and she's doing her expenses. So, yeah, she's good to go.
She's a perfect adult in training. That is wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Have a good day.
Oh, you have a good day too, Jill. Thank you for calling in. Michelle, when it comes to spending either of these stimulus checks, what do you recommend people do first with this money, especially when there are so many bills to pay?
Yeah, so I would always encourage people to pay the bills that are necessities. you know, your rent, food, utilities, if you need your car to get to work. You may have credit card debt and some other bills that you want to try to address. And normally you might if you had all the income. But if you don't, you got to take care of the necessities first. Don't worry about those credit card bills now. But if you can't make those payments, call your creditors and let them know what the situation is, that you've lost your job or you have less income, and see if you can get a forbearance on having to pay that so you can like, push that payment in the future. But if you've got limited money, take care of the things that you absolutely need, a roof over your head and food on the table.
Michelle, thank you for joining us.
You're so welcome.
Michelle Singletary is a personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. She writes the nationally syndicated column, The Color of Money. Ahead this hour, nursing homes are hard hit in the pandemic, but vaccines are arriving at long-term care facilities around Wisconsin. What is the status of your loved one at a nursing home? 800-642-1234. We check in on the COVID vaccine rollout. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just ahead, we find out the status of COVID vaccines for loved ones and staff at hard-hit nursing homes. But first, it's Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about someone who saved a life by doing his job.
When we're at work, we all have a number of roles. We can take on other jobs, wear several hats. Albert Watson is a detention officer at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center, where he also hosts a cooking club. Here, he tells the story of the day he saved a life by taking a bit of his own advice.
I had 10 minutes left of my shift before it was time to go home. I was headed to the control room to relinquish my equipment when the timer went off. I informed my coworker, Walter, that I'd head back to the pod to check on the male youth. See, every 25 minutes, our policy is to check on every kid that's in their room. This was the kid whose mood seemed to change as the day went on. It seemed like the more people he talked to, whether it be his social worker, public defender, the police, the more emotional he became. I've been a detention officer for almost 10 years at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center. I've been training for a lead worker position and recently became the president of the Wisconsin Juvenile Detention Association. For the past 5 years, I've facilitated a cooking group at detention. No, I have not been to culinary school. My passion for cooking started with my dad. I'm the oldest of four boys, and my dad would get us up at 6:30 a.m. just so we could eat breakfast, consistent of sausage, salt pork, homemade biscuits, eggs, and tomato gravy. Yeah, I'm crunching in the sugar sandwich. My dad could take some neck bones and barbecue them in the oven and make us licking our fingers shortly after engaging that dish. So when I cook with these kids, it's from the heart and with love. We made many dishes over the last 5 years, from deep fried Twinkies and Oreos to fried chicken and waffles. We've done homemade meatloaf, five cheese macaroni, lasagna and homemade garlic bread, patty melts, paninis. We always like to celebrate other cultures, so during the month of March, giving respect to the Irish, we did corned beef and cabbage, shamrock shakes, and bangers and mash, which isn't really an Irish dish, but was one of the recipes that popped up when I Googled Irish dishes. And I can't forget the Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid is special when you're locked up. I bet y'all wondering, what do the kids get when they don't earn the lunch? They get hot dogs. Hot dogs are boiled for about 4 hours. All I do is keep adding water to them. These turkey franks go from looking light brown color to this pale off-white spongy Vienna sausage frank. I once added green food coloring on St. Patrick's Day. I'm a damn fool at work. Some people think it's mean or cruel. I call it get your together. I can't reward negative behavior. You can't disrespect staff or be verbally abusive and earn the lunch. You can't steal a car on Wednesday night, get locked up, and earn the special lunch on Thursday. We'll shoot for next Thursday. The point I'm trying to make is, do your job. A kid that's incarcerated has only one job, and that's to follow the program so you can get the hell up out of detention. As I entered B-Pod, I walked to a room, B3. As I opened a small window of B3, I wasn't sure if what I was seeing was real, but it was. The male youth was hanging from the side of his toilet sink. I radioed for staff to call 911 and asked for assistance in B-Pod. I then opened the door of B3 and entered. Walter had just arrived. I instructed Walter to open the first aid drawer and grab the scissors from the first aid kit. You know, once I had the scissors in my hand, I began cutting the part of the sheet that was wrapped around this kid's neck. The kid let out this grunt of a sound, which let me know that he just might be okay. I gently placed this kid on the floor and wrapped several blankets on him to make him as comfortable as I could. Continued to talk to him and assure him that he was going to be okay. The point I'm trying to make is that I was doing my job that day. That timer went off after 25 minutes and that kid needed to be checked. A good thing happened from doing my job, and that's what I try to teach these kids during their short stay, the Dade County Juvenile Detention Center.
Albert Watson's story came to us from the podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. He's a detention officer at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center and just finished his term as president of the Wisconsin Juvenile Detention Association. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
And now we check in on Wisconsin nursing homes battling the pandemic. Thousands of long-term care facility residents and staff have received a COVID vaccine in recent days. Has your loved one? Join in 800-642-1234. Stephanie Shadid is president and CEO of Luther Manor. It's a nonprofit Christian senior community in Wauwatosa. Stephanie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
We also have John Sauer with us, CEO of Leading Age Wisconsin. It's an advocacy organization, has 200 nonprofit member organizations, including nursing homes, assisted living, and independent facilities. John, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Kate. Good to be here.
Well, John, bring us up to speed here. The state allocated roughly 57,000 doses for long-term care facilities. What is the status of these doses?
Well, I think it's been somewhat impressive in where we have come as a country and a state, because we are using the Moderna vaccine in long-term care. That's been the vaccine that's been designated to be available to long-term care facilities, including nursing facilities and assisted living facilities. And the federal approval of Moderna happened around December 18th, final approval on the 20th, and 8 days later, we were putting shots in the arms of nursing home residents and staff. That first happened on December 28th. That first week of the vaccine program, which is called the Federal Pharmacy Partnership Program for Long-Term Care. So there are two separate programs, but for long-term care, the partnership program is how nursing homes and assisted living will receive the vaccines directly from Walgreens and CVS. We had 39 facilities vaccinated last week, and the Department of Health Services tells us that by Monday of next week, we hope to have about half of the nursing homes be visited by the two institutional pharmacies. So by Monday, we should be halfway there with the nursing facilities. And the institutional pharmacies tell us that by January 25th at the latest, they hope to have visited all 360 nursing homes.
Okay, so it's really in these next few crucial weeks that we're going to see, a real surge in residents and staff getting this vaccine.
That is what we're hoping, praying for, and anticipate will happen. And I do think having 39 facilities be visited in a kind of an interrupted week with New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, and just the beginning to kind of learn how to do this, because it hasn't been done at this level of this scale before.
Logistics,
I think
logistics
we're making
matter.
Some progress, right? Exactly.
Stephanie, bring us up to speed what Luther Manor is receiving in terms of vaccines.
You bet. So yesterday we held our first clinic. We're very excited. In fact, John laid out a terrific timeline, and I guess I really have to reinforce for listeners how quickly this has come into our facility. Yesterday it was actually a week sooner than we were originally told. So wow. We began planning as soon as we knew that the Pfizer vaccine was approved, and you know at that time not entirely sure which we would be getting. So we began our planning and logistics and thinking through things as much as we could. There was very little information, but having gone through testing for COVID, we knew that things would probably be bumpy, right? Things would probably be uncertain. We would probably get a lot of information at the very last minute. And then in this case with the vaccine, we also needed to do a lot of educating of staff, of residents, of family members to make sure that they had everything they needed to be comfortable with the decision when the vaccine eventually did reach our campus, which was yesterday.
Yeah, Stephanie, how are loved ones, family members consulted or apprised of the status of their nursing home residents getting the vaccine? How can they ensure that the loved one is getting it?
Sure. We have had conversations with every family member. Some of our residents are their own person, as we deem it and call it in the industry. So we've had conversations with them. Certainly, we provide them with all of the detailed information. Moderna has put together a very, very comprehensive, I'll call it a Q&A, but information sheet that is provided to every resident or family member. We've spent a lot of time answering questions, addressing concerns and fears. There's been so much in different areas. You can either watch the news or go on the internet and find anything that will suit your own concern. And we've spent a lot of time trying to help people understand what we believe is the facts and data behind the vaccine and the science behind it. But ultimately, they're all free to make their own choice. So we've spent a lot of time trying to reassure folks that whatever their decision, we are caring for their loved one. Their loved one will be, if they choose to get the vaccine, we will make sure that it is, you know, safe with their physician, number one, that they're comfortable getting it, number two, and that we observe them for a period of time afterwards to ensure there's no adverse effects.
What do you think your uptake will be? Do you have any idea on the percentage of your residents and staff who will get the vaccine?
Yeah, so in this first clinic, we had been successful in reaching more than probably 60% of our staff. The vaccine is not available to anyone under 18, and we have a number of students and younger folks that work for us, especially in our dining areas. So removing them and some of our staff that work on a very, very temporary basis or part-time basis with us, we are easily in the 60% range, which I think was a terrific success given how quickly we had to deploy this.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of third shift staff, as an example, or other folks who didn't work yesterday who just were not able to get here either. So that was, I think, a big success. We're looking forward to our second clinic in early February when all of the folks from yesterday will receive their second dose. And then we're hoping that the staff members who were reluctant to get it in the first round step forward and make sure that they get vaccinated as well.
And that they can get their first dose then on that date in February?
That's right.
Okay.
And then
there
will be a third clinic in March to ensure that they get their second dose. And honestly, that's about 3 months away from now. So things might change. Maybe we'll have even more opportunities to have clinics so that we can get our assisted living residents vaccinated and we can start to deploy it sooner to our independent living residents who are all in that age 65 and older band.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
John, what can you tell us about vaccines for people who are in the assisted living or in independent facilities?
We've been meeting with the vaccinators, Walgreens and CVS, and state DHS, Department of Health Services officials. Again, we met with them just late yesterday. The system that the federal government has set up requires a two-week notice before we go on to the next phase. I'm hoping that we might have that notification happen as early as Monday. One of the issues is we have to have sufficient inventory before we, you know, as everyone's been calling it, press the button to say we're going to signal the start of finding doses for 140 people in assisted living. That would be residents and staff. So that is a tall order. But what we have to do is we have to have sufficient inventory of the vaccine so that when we deploy people out to over 5,000 facilities, that we have the inventory to draw from so that we can show up with a sufficient number of vaccines. I'm
sufficient
hoping that
doses.
Happens.
Yeah. John Sauer, CEO of Leading Age Wisconsin. We have Stephanie Shadid, president and CEO of Luther Manor in Wauwatosa. Do you work in a nursing home that is maybe understaffed due to COVID quarantines? How are you coping with the shortage? What challenges do you face as you care for a vulnerable population? Has your loved one been in a nursing home with a COVID outbreak? How is that situation? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about vaccine rollout. Residents of nursing homes and other long-term care facilities represent 27% of deaths from COVID in Wisconsin. That is the latest from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Do you work at a long-term care facility? Have you been vaccinated? What can you tell us about the status of your residents? 800-642-1234. John Sauer is CEO of Leading Age Wisconsin. Stephanie Shadid is here. She's CEO of Luther Manor in Wauwatosa. They're with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Barb now in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Barb.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling about the lack of an emergency response to get the vaccine into a facility that is now having an outbreak of COVID. This is happening here in Chippewa Falls at the Wisconsin Veterans Home, and they are not scheduled to get the vaccine until January 15th. And in the last week, they have had 11 residents come down with COVID and four staff.
Yeah.
And the facility has asked for an earlier date by CVS, but has been denied that.
Okay, and so Barb wondering about an ongoing outbreak, what does that mean for getting vaccines into nursing homes that is dealing with an outbreak? John, go ahead.
Well, I think a couple of things are probably in the works. I would suspect that the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs is having conversations with the Department of Health Services about what happens in an outbreak. But I have to say, COVID is everywhere in the state of Wisconsin, and we've had an unbelievable surge happening in throughout the state. And when it happens like that, it's also happening in long-term care. I have to just say there are 300-plus active investigations in nursing homes right now that have at least one case of COVID. Now, it might be staff, it might be residents, but that's what we're dealing with, and that's why we have to get the vaccines out to people as quickly as possible. And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, perhaps there's some way to move the date up. But I can tell you that, and I wish I didn't have to tell you this, that it's not an isolated situation where a nursing home has an outbreak. That has happened in the state of Wisconsin. And our data would show that Wisconsin nursing homes are doing better than, far better than the national average. Our death rate is far below the national average. But that doesn't mean we're in a comfort zone by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that the Veterans Home, as it's been reported here, is alone in combating an outbreak. And I wish that was not the case.
Barb, we appreciate your call. Stephanie, what can you share about Luther Manor and how you handle outbreaks?
Sure. We were actually handling it over the weekend. As John said, that we are amongst pretty much every facility in the state that are experiencing additional staff cases. As soon as we have any indication, we've been testing staff twice a week, so as soon as we get a test back or a staff member has any type of symptom, they stay away. We keep them at home. We ask them to stay home. And then we immediately begin isolating the unit and quarantining the unit. All of our staff are wearing full PPE. That means a face shield and a mask and gloves when appropriate and gowns. And cleaning has just become more than a full-time job for us. So making sure that we isolate the individual that has tested positive, we then test residents every 72 hours, sometimes every 48 hours, to make sure that they are safe. When we do have a resident that is positive, we move them to our COVID specialty unit that we have in our short-term rehabilitation area. And that unit helps to continue to, number one, isolate the virus, because so those residents don't spread it to others, staff members or residents. Mm-hmm. But it also allows us to treat them for specific conditions that we have seen that come from COVID to make sure they get the best care possible.
Yeah, and so you have to act very quickly, I'm sure, with, you know, making sure that you isolate it right away.
Absolutely. That's imperative.
Let's bring in Pam now in Green Bay. Pam, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling to ask, are group homes considered to be assisted living or long-term care? Because generally they are, but they're a lot smaller than a regular nursing home. I have a son in a group home in Green Bay. They just had their first case test positive within the last few days. And so I'm concerned about, is this group home group to be included with the long-term care?
John, can you field that?
Generally speaking, group homes will be if they are licensed as adult family homes. So these are smaller facilities of four units or perhaps larger, but under adult family homes, they are included in the definition of assisted living. So they're within the 70,000 residents in the state that are targeted for that second rollout for assisted living. So I'm hoping your group home is licensed as adult family home, and if so, it will be included.
Pam, we appreciate the call. Stephanie, your residents haven't had visitors in since March, and you know that alone is just gut-wrenching. It just brings tears to my eyes. How are you dealing with the separation pain that families are feeling?
Yeah, sure. It's been a challenge for sure, and our staff have really stepped up to replace families as much as we possibly can, but we know there's really no replacement for a loved one. We actually have had visitors on our campus, so I want to make sure that that's known. In our independent living, our assisted living, and our skilled nursing, we have done in-person visits when it was safe to do and when the resident was in the condition that it was allowed. We screen everyone that comes in. There are lots of protocols on making sure that the person coming into the facility is well, that they don't have a pending case, a pending test outstanding, and then we do a good deal of high-touch cleaning. But that is not the norm, and as soon as we have a case in the building, we do have to quarantine the unit, and those visits stop. So it's been a challenge, but we have done as much as we possibly can to use other new technologies, and we were able to receive a grant from the state of Wisconsin to assist in buying iPads, which has really helped in doing both visits with families, but also visits with physicians to make sure that they stay connected there as well.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Stephanie Shadid, CEO of Luther Manor, a senior community in Wauwatosa. And we had John Sauer, CEO of Leading Age Wisconsin, an advocacy organization. Just ahead, can emerging carbon capture technologies be developed soon enough to scrub greenhouse gas emissions from the atmosphere and avoid catastrophic climate change? We tackle that question with you on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Ideas Network.